Welcome everybody. Thank you for being here. I will go around and say hi to each person. Ted, can you hear us yet? welcome. And Drew, Jill, and Franklin, and Susan, and Jim, Jinryu, Mark Tilson, Yeshe, Joan, Jason, Bob, Walt, Sam, Jeff, Paul, Matt, Karen, and Ruth Ann. All right. I guess in terms of announcements, a couple things. I still don't know, our board still doesn't know what, you know, our reopening, when and where that's going to happen. If anyone has any questions or suggestions or something like that, you're welcome to email me with them. So there really hasn't been any discussion about it, but from what I've been able to tell from my reading is that meeting for prolonged periods together in enclosed spaces like our Zendo is kind of like one of the last things that's going to come around. So I would anticipate it'll probably be another month or two at least before we're meeting in person. I think we need, you know, the board and or there will be a teachers advisory council meeting this month as well. So we can talk at greater length about, you know, if we do go longer, are there some other things that we want to incorporate into our, do we want to all get together for a big socially distanced picnic on a nice day or something like that? And we do still have a plan to do our Jukai on July 14th, I believe it is, outside. So we'll be planning that. On another note, I will be starting to offer Sanzen, so one-on-one interview during Zazen. So I'll do that on Tuesday evenings and on Sundays during the second period of meditation. And if you haven't done that before, that's meant to be a very brief one-on-one interaction with the teacher where you bring a question. Holy moly. Bob just sent me a note. First Unitarian in Portland has suspended in-person meetings through June 2021. Wow. I don't think I'm ready to even absorb that information. Thank goodness we can at least see each other online. So let's see, what was I saying? Oh, right. Sanzen. So the idea is to have, you know, aim for maybe like a 5-minute interaction and where you bring a question or you just kind of check in about your practice. And I will do that. The way that I will do that is if you put your name in the chat, then I will create, it's kind of weird, but I have to create breakout rooms and then I send you to the breakout room and you have to accept the invitation to the breakout room and then I join you. and then we have to end the breakout room and I pop back and then I have to create more breakout rooms. So it's not an elegant process, but basically if you sign up, you will at some point during Zazen get an invitation to a breakout room and then we can meet one-on-one, which it's a surprisingly intimate experience, even though it's on video. And also, if you do want to come to do that, be sure to, you know, put your name in the chat early on in Zazen, as opposed to partway through. Because if nobody signs up or I'm done meeting with people, I'm just going to sit zazen. So not going to keep an eye on the chat. Any questions about that? In terms of what we're going to be studying on Tuesdays, so we're still on Thich Nhat Hanh's book, No Death, No Fear, and I had planned to cover 3 chapters tonight, but as I was going through it, I thought, well, people seem to like it enough, let's do it one more week. So tonight I was going to do chapter 7 and most of chapter 8. And then there was kind of a nice break there with the end of chapter 8 and chapter 9 really had to do more with directly with death and dying and the dying process and facing death. So I figured that could be something that we cover next week. Then after that, we'll be going through, I'm not sure how many weeks it will take us, but we'll be working on one of my favorite books ever, which I have a terrible memory, so I keep an actual spreadsheet of the talks and classes that we've done at Brightway. And I was surprised to see that at least my spreadsheet goes back to like beginning of 2015. And I have never, like at least since then, I have not covered Uchiyama Roshi's book, How to Cook Your Life, Teachings from the Tenzo Kyokan. So this book is, it's available. It focuses on Dogen Zenji's essay, Instructions for the Head Cook, which is just a beautiful essay, and it has a lot to do with practice in our daily lives and in our work. But the bulk of the book isn't that, it's Uchiyama Roshi's commentary on it, and it tends to be very, very down to earth and very relevant for our daily zazen in practice. So I'm hoping folks will like it. I know that the book group read something by Uchiyama Roshi and appreciated it. So there'll be more information about that in the newsletter. So let's see. Don't have a immediate clock in front of me, so I will go on to tonight's class then. So chapters 7 and 8 of No Death, No Fear, Continuing Manifestations was the title of chapter 7, and The Practice of Touching the Earth was chapter 8. So as I have done before, I want to open it up for if anyone has any sections from those chapters that struck you, that you really enjoyed, and or if you have any things that he said that you have questions about or want to throw open for some discussion. So I'll just... go ahead and unmute yourself if you have something. I'll just leave a few minutes here for us to reflect and page through our books.
I have something.
Yeah.
When I make a pot of oolong tea, I put tea leaves into the pot and pour boiling water on them. 5 minutes later, there is tea to drink. When I drink it, oolong tea is going into me. I'm going to skip just a little bit ahead because it's a little repetitive. After I've poured out all the tea, what will be left in the pot is just spent tea leaves. The leaves that remain are only a very small part of the tea. The tea that goes into me is a much bigger part of the tea. It is the richest part. We are the same. Mm-hmm. Our essence is gone into our children, our friends, and the entire universe. We have to find ourselves in those directions and not in the spent tea leaves.
When I read that, I just thought, of course. why do we forget this? So he just makes it seem so accessible and obvious in a way.
I like what he says about the ancestors. Where was it? Visualize the presence of all your ancestors in you. It's not difficult because you are, in fact, them. You are their continuation.
I liked, it's in chapter 7. I'm reading from a Kindle version, so I'm not really sure if the pages match up, but in the Kindle version, it's page 123. I don't know how well that matches with the paperback or the paper version. He talks about, in the morning when I do sitting meditation, to my left and to my right are monks. I've been reborn in them by sitting with them. If you look carefully, you will see me in them. I'm not waiting to be reborn after I die. I'm being reborn in this moment, and I want to be reborn in a good direction. I want to hand on to my lay and monastic friends the most happy, beautiful, and happy things of my life so that they can have a good rebirth for me and for themselves.
I agree. I also liked that passage, and I also highlighted, you do not have to wait until the flame has gone out to be reborn. Mm-hmm. I'm reborn many times every day. Every moment is a moment of rebirth. My practice is to be reborn in such a way that my new forms of manifestations will bring light, freedom, and happiness into the world.
Yes, and I like that. In touching the earth, the historical dimension on 137 of the book, it says, if you are both your blood ancestors and your spiritual ancestors, you touch the presence of your father and mother in each cell of your body. They are truly present in you, along with your grandparents and great-grandparents. Doing this, you realized you are their continuation. You may have thought that your ancestors no longer existed, but even scientists will say that they are present in you, in your genetic heritage, which is in every cell of your body.
So clearly this sense of, I've never really encountered this before, this imagery of rebirth as, like, you know, rebirth every moment and rebirth in all the things around us. It sounds like that appealed to people. Why do you think we forget about that? Why do you think we don't usually function as if that is the case?
It's kind of hard to work against your habit energy. I mean, isn't that the struggle? I mean, I've been told this many times that I can start my day over again in any moment. Do I do that? Only when I'm at a point where I'm so low that I remember.
Yeah, and to remind ourselves, of this stuff regularly, I think that's part of practice.
Well, I think it's hard to remember it partly because we think of ourselves as so separate, or at least I do, so separate from everything rather than a part of everything. So, which is a whole different way to look at things.
Yeah. So really, I think I'm getting really distracted by all the chats. I'm sorry. I cannot not read things. So, I don't know if you can maybe postpone conversations until after this. That'd be great. Yeah, I think this, in some ways, Thich Nhat Hanh's words are really, he's really good at conveying this, at kind of poetically inviting you to into this space, into this way of seeing things. But of course that is, and he said it earlier in the book as well, like the practice is making this more real to us, like more and more real, awakening to it in a more and more direct way. Because as long as it stays somewhat, you know, intellectual, it's not as much of a refuge, right? It's like when we're feeling good, you go, oh yeah, oh, that's really sweet. But when we're threatened, like there's a whole different thing going on when we're physically or emotionally or whatever feeling a little more at risk, a little more separate.
And I don't know if this is just me, but so I can be mindful of these things when, you know, when I'm by myself, more likely, or if I'm outside or whatever. But the minute I'm with other people, it just goes away. I don't know. There's so many different things going on that come up and totally goes away. I don't know how to start to bring that in, you know, to when I'm with people, because it's just gone. I don't know if that's the same for everybody or if it's just me.
From what I've heard and in my own experience, dealing with other people is the most challenging. Like, what do they say? It's easy to be enlightened if you're off in a cave, you're a hermit in a cave. Like, that is the final frontier. Practice is other people, is being in a social situation and interacting with other people, I think.
I say that there's that old saying that you think you're enlightened, try spending a weekend with your family, you know.
Exactly.
I think it might have been Mark Twain who said, "I love humanity, it's people I can't stand."
Well, it's good to know I'm not alone in that then.
So let's see.
Can I add one?
Yeah.
I just came across this, and I don't know what chapter it's in. It's in the last three. But in the book, it's on page 155. And the title of the section caught my attention, frankly, because of the way I felt today. It says, "Don't drown in despair." It says we have to practice to protect our children and ourselves from despair. Bodhisattvas can stand up and resist despair by their ability to listen deeply, to love, to understand, and to be deeply committed. As we touch the earth the second time, we are in contact with great and small bodhisattvas everywhere, and we feel their energy. So this is sort of in connection with being connected to our ancestors. And I won't read it all, but he goes on to ask the question again, how can we stop ourselves from collapsing in despair? It is because Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are present in the world. They are not somewhere else in a faraway paradise. Whether we are living or dying, they are here with us. So that was very helpful to me today.
I think sometimes that's what's so painful. about watching injustice and oppression and destruction and all this kind of stuff, when like we also know, we also see, we also taste that bodhisattva heart. You know how people can be and how beautiful it is. So it's like, well, what? You know, you could be like this. Why are you doing this? You know, it's kind of trite, but it's like, why can't we all just get along? You know, there is this goodness in people, and it often manifests. I don't know. I mean, it reminds me of a story I've shared a couple times of visiting a friend who has dementia and chronic pain and is, you know, going downhill mentally and physically, and going to visit her in a nursing home and feeling sad she was in the nursing home, and sad being surrounded by all the people in the nursing home who once, you know, they once had lives and they once had, you know, intelligence, and they once had, you know, things going, and now they're reduced to, you know, just basically just survival, and, you know, just the sadness of it. And but then I don't know what it was that made me shift, and then I started, when I went in to go visit her, I started to focus on the incredible service and compassion of the staff and the family members. And it was just like all of that was present, right? The sadness and the loss was present. But then at the same time, like in that same field, it was this amazing, you know, center of people just, you know, patiently feeding people and taking care of people and cleaning people and speaking kindly to people. And I don't know, that was, and transformed the whole experience. So I'm going to jump kind of into the middle of the sections that we're studying tonight, and then we'll go a little bit back. But first of all, to talk about how in Buddhism, we, from the beginning, there's been this practice of reflecting on death, on contemplating death, in a very deliberate way. So Thich Nhat Hanh talks about that as saying we have to recognize. So he talks about, and I'll talk about this a little more in a minute, but many of you are familiar, I think, with the five remembrances, a very ancient Buddhist chant, prayer, meditation, where say the way that Thich Nhat Hanh writes it out is, breathing in and out, I am aware of the fact that I am of the nature to die. I cannot escape dying. I am of the nature to grow old. I cannot escape old age. I am of the nature to get sick. Because I have a body, I cannot avoid sickness. Everything I cherish, treasure, and cling to today, I will have to abandon one day. The only thing I can carry with me is the fruit of my own action. I cannot bring along with me anything else except the fruit of my actions in terms of thought, speech, and bodily acts. So Thich Nhat Hanh says, we have to recognize this reality and smile. This is the practice of facing our own fear. Fear is always there within us, the fear of getting old, the fear of getting sick, the fear of dying, the fear of being abandoned by our loved ones. It is very human to be fearful and to worry about it. The Buddha did not advise us to suppress these fears. The Buddha advised us to invite these fears to the upper level of our consciousness, recognize them, and smile at them. Smile at them, of course, is Thich Nhat Hanh's own spin on it. To do so was a daily practice for monks and nuns in the time of the Buddha, as it is for monks and nuns now. Every time your fear is invited up, Every time you recognize it and smile at it, your fear will lose some of its strength. When it returns to the depths of your consciousness, it returns as a smaller seed. That is why the practice should be done every day, especially when you are feeling mentally and physically strong. So, again, it's that I am of the nature to grow old. I am of the nature to get sick. I am of the nature to die. And as you, and the recommendation is that as you're doing this, I mean, you're doing this, you contemplate this with, you know, several breaths. You absorb the reality of this as much as possible. So, I wanted to split us out into groups very briefly and ask people to speak to how was the matter of death dealt with in your family of origin? And I was going to say, or in your the religion or spiritual tradition you grew up in, but I didn't want the discussion just to be, you know, explaining to one another what the beliefs of Christianity are, but kind of more in your own experience of growing up, the situations of people you found yourself surrounded by. How was death dealt with, viewed? Was it talked about? Was it contemplated, etc.? All of this is kind of a contrast to, you know, this Buddhist approach, which is very, very head on. So give me a moment here while I rearrange the room so they're not too disproportionate. And if you don't want to say anything, by all means, just say you want to pass. But I do encourage everybody to say something. Had a theme like ours did, which is for the most part in our culture, death is not talked about, even when it's like somebody's died, even when something's, you know, we're actually faced with it, it's kind of minimized, put out of our mind, almost as if we just, you just, I don't, it's almost like it's a jinx to talk about it, right? If you talk about it, you're just kind of inviting death to come knocking at the door somehow, almost a superstitious kind of thing that if we just ignore it, you know, maybe it's inevitable, but it's certainly not worth talking about a lot. So our Buddhist approach is very different, and I think many of you probably already know that there was a, you know, monks in the Buddha's time were, you know, the eventual dissolution of the body, the impermanence of all the aspects of being a human being, form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness, to contemplate their impermanence regularly. The five remembrances, obviously, was one of the meditations. But they even did meditation in charnel grounds. They did meditations where corpses were burned. And so clearly facing this reality and trying to really absorb it was part of the practice, was a very, I mean, I don't know about central in the sense that death, maybe physical death itself isn't necessarily a central meditation, but impermanence is certainly a central meditation. No self, not being attached to our form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness is central. So, hey, you know, I guess the way that I look at it for myself is that we can always go more deeply into this in essentially preparing for our death. So even in Vajrayana Buddhism, they take this to certain Vajrayana forms of Buddhism take this way beyond what any, you know, Theravadan or Zen does. They actually, like, you train for the moment of death. You train for how to let go and how to relate to your body and how to move into the next realm. And so they get very, 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 very specific. So we don't get that specific, but there's considered to be a value in really facing this stuff so that we are not left at the last minute realizing we didn't explore this sufficiently. And I'm reminded of being with my grandma when she was nearing death, or maybe it's that I heard, I don't think I was there actually toward the end, but a cousin was, and she had been a lifelong Catholic, or she converted to Catholicism, but she'd been a lifelong Christian. But on her deathbed, she had doubts. You know, on her deathbed, it's like, am I really sure? Am I really sure that I'm going to heaven, that, you know, Christ is waiting for me, etc.? And to me, that felt like, you know, when we haven't explored our faith deeply enough, then there could be some doubt at that last moment. So this kind of imagery that Thich Nhat Hanh offers us of being reborn in every moment. I think it sounds like I said earlier, everybody really resonated with that, with tea leaves, that when we die, it's just tea leaves. The tea has gone out into all of our, all of the people in our lives and all of the things that we have done. And I like how he said, you know, he's written books and now he's in prison. He said, I am now in prison. Like there's part of him that is in the prisons. So I was curious about what people thought about toward the end of that section where he's talking about this being reborn in every moment and thinking about how we want to be reborn, right? Do we want to be reborn in positive ways versus negative ways? And he talked about being reborn every moment of the past, which I thought was really intriguing. And he tells the story of the man who was in war and ended up American Vietnam vet. And he had killed five Vietnamese children in an incredibly gruesome way. And he says, after he returned to the United States, the soldier could not overcome his guilt. But he talks about this. Eventually, he gets to know this guy, and the guy practices. And Thich Nhat Hanh says, you have killed five children, it is true. But you can save the lives of hundreds of children. Do you know that every day, tens of thousands of children die for want of food and medicine? You can bring food and medicine to some of them. He practiced as I advised, and that person who 20 years ago had killed five children was immediately reborn in the past as someone who saved the lives of 20 children. So I wanted to throw that out there. It's like, what does this mean?
Well, for me, it was a story of redemption, you know, that he discovered a way to redeem himself that was quite effective. So I think Thich Nhat Hanh just pointed him in that direction. You know?
that he says something about, like, he's reborn in the past, which is something that we don't usually, like, think about that, right? You're reborn in the future, or maybe you can picture, like, in this moment, right? You're reborn in the effects that you have on people right here now. I thought it was very interesting to suggest that because of his redemption, somehow that affects the past.
Hmm. Well, I think there's forgiveness in it, isn't there?
Hmm.
For me,
oh, you muted yourself, Walt.
He could forgive himself. No longer. His mind was no longer in a state of, in a solid anymore around it. That's how it hit me.
Did you want to say something, Ruth Ann?
Oh, yes. The former soldier, I think, was carrying that pain on his heart and his body, and so that rebirth from his earlier actions was like a rejuvenation of what the baggage he still held. No one would know that other than himself, but the fact that Thich Nhat Hanh, I think, uses rebirth as a rejuvenation, as you say, in the present, but it, because space and time is what we've put packaging on, but it doesn't mean we're tied only to the very, kind of definitions we give to what rebirth can mean.
I wonder if, and this is kind of goes along with what Walt said, that how he was reborn in the past was when he brought food to the hungry children. Those actions, not replaced, but redeemed him, or he was forgiven somehow for killing the children. So it brought him back to that same place where he did the original act somehow, you know, at that same point. I don't know if that makes sense. Anyway.
Yeah, and I don't know if people have had the experience as well of, coming to a point of forgiveness, perhaps, or understanding of someone in the past who has hurt you. And then somehow it's like, it changes the past in a way, or at least it changes your narrative of the past. So there's that interesting way that it almost reaches back and heals something. Even though, you can't really technically go back and change what happened. So what did people think about Thich Nhat Hanh's touching the earth practices? So he recommends some very, very specific practice in this chapter, Fear, Acceptance, and Forgiveness, the practice of touching the earth. So just for some background, in case it's anybody who isn't familiar with it, this the touching the earth iconography and practice is inspired by the story of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment, where he, according to the mythology, he's sitting, he finally has kind of come across the middle way. His path forward is clear. So he's sitting in great determination, and he's, it's the final, it's the culmination of his spiritual practice, and he's about to awaken. But he experiences, the the interpretation of the mythology is he experiences doubt. The mythology is that, you know, Mara, the tempter, comes and, you know, taunts him and throws things at him and things like that. So he experiences some doubt or is challenged by Mara, and the way that Shakyamuni responds, because Mara basically says, who do you think you are? To be, you know, essentially coming up with a new enlightenment. Who do you think you are? And Shakyamuni reaches down and touches the earth and asks the earth to testify to his practice. And so you'll often see the statues of Buddha reaching down with his right hand and touching the earth. And if you've ever done that practice, either in a meditation posture or some similar kind of, you know, grounding, touching the earth practice, there's something very powerful about it. There's something very, you know, that you can't just explain, you know, it's not just about thoughts or feelings or interpretations. There's something physical and real about it. So he recommends, Thich Nhat Hanh recommends, he says, touching the earth is an easy and effective way to touch our ultimate dimension. If you do this practice, one day you will touch your true nature of no birth and no death. At that time, you will be liberated from fear. You can become someone who rides majestically on the waves of birth and death because you are no longer agitated by fear or anger. So he has a very specific practice recommendation where you do three kinds of touching the earth, and the third kind we'll talk about next week. But the two kinds he calls the vertical and the horizontal. So the vertical, he says, is like, which I think I really wanted to lead us all through it. Maybe I'll do it next week. But because it's that kind of thing, you read it in a book and you think that'd be a cool meditation to do, but you don't necessarily do it, you know. So I mean, maybe I'd recommend just like recording yourself saying it, so then you can just listen to it. But anyway, maybe we'll try it next week. So, but the vertical was to, you know, touch the earth or to bow, so that you are touching the earth with your you're on your knees and you're touching the earth with your forehead and your hands. And then you picture that, you know, your ancestors through time kind of above you, and your descendants, even if we don't have children, you know, the people that we've touched, the things that we have done, whatever, picturing them below us, and to accept them all. I think that's a very, I wanted to throw that out there as a question, to say, why does he recommend that? You know, in this touching the earth practice that is supposed to help us touch our, you know, our fearlessness, touch our ultimate dimension. And why does he start with this, you know, envisioning the ancestors and the descendants, and somehow accepting ourselves and accepting everything that we've come from and everything that will come after? Any thoughts? I don't know if anybody actually did this yet or not.
Well, I think one of the reasons that he did it is because, first of all, you have to be able to accept yourself to do this. Before you can accept anybody else, you have to be able to accept yourself. And so, you know, in thinking about your parents, you know, you can think about, you have to accept all parts of them that you love and parts of them that drive you crazy. So, and you might find parts that drive you crazy about your parents, you might find inside of yourself. So I just think it's very humbling and real. I just find it very powerful.
Anyone else? Other thoughts? Well, maybe we'll revisit that next week and kind of contemplate that question about this. We start with that touching the earth, and Jinryu actually pointed out a week ago or so how he mentioned solidity, and he does that again in one of these places in these chapters, that if we do this, then we have this solidity to offer, which is kind of like an interesting, you know, when we're kind of talking about no self, and it's a manifestation that changes and comes and goes like a cloud. And what is this, you know, what is the solidity? So I think it's kind of tied to some of this, you know, touching the earth and doing this centering practice. And then of course the next one is he says the horizontal. So the vertical is in time and the horizontal is in space. And then it's this contemplation of interbeing and continuation with all beings. And he emphasizes a lot about the bodhisattvas, you know, that so we have this interbeing with all beings, perfect and imperfect, and seeing ourselves and everyone in ourselves. But also there's a lot of emphasis on like, look for the bodhisattvas in order to stave off the despair. So yeah, I'll leave it there. Thank you all for coming. Have a good rest of your evening.